It was tough, but it was so good to learn. Competition was high, and in the first year, I had a lot to learn, really. And in the second year, I won the series.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Partners in Time. It's very nice to have you once again. Today, I'm joined by a special guest. I'm here with Laura Kreihammer from Austria, a racing driver. And joining me, I don't even know whereabouts in the world you are, Laura. Are you in Salzburg? Whereabouts am I catching you?
Hi.
Hello.
Yes. Hi, Chris. Thank you for having me. Yes, I'm sitting in Salzburg, actually.
And you also, we just touched on it in the sort of off-air intro a little bit already. You are actually one of the few people as well who are actually traveling occasionally in these sort of locked down times. I just had my first proper flight experience yesterday. It was quite shocking, but you're quite mobile still, right?
Yes, yes, absolutely. It didn't take a long time for me since the whole pandemic started. I traveled again last June already.
Wow. Well, I always knew I should have become a racing driver. I would have been. We could have gotten out of Schaffhausen that way.
You wouldn't believe it, but traveling not the best part about racing, actually.
Yeah, well, yes. But, you know, that's the thing. Like when the whole thing started, did you actually ever miss the process of traveling, or was it just being in places and meeting people and doing your thing? And
I think actually in the first stage, I really enjoyed the traveling because it's quite exciting, you know, taking flights all over the world, taking like the first time in business class, things like this.
You fly
it's
business
really
class,
exciting.
Cheeky.
I did once.
Wow.
I did once.
I am
actually.
Jealous.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. It was.
It's all right,
I mean,
for some, isn't it?
It's like in a hotel room. It's an absolute privilege, and it's so exciting and a great experience for a young woman like me. Honestly, I really enjoyed it. But actually, I think after some time, I could skip the traveling and just enjoy being in places straight away.
Yeah, teleportation. It's much nicer. It actually it struck me the whole. I mean, I've literally been, you know, sort of. Car and walking a mobile only for the last year or so, and in this entire time I have not missed, and this is quite ironic seeing that we make a lot of pilots watches, but I have not missed the inside of a commercial aircraft, like for even 1 second. It feels a little bit like it's sort of back to square one, because the last sort of 50 years of aviation have all been about increased convenience, connectivity, flights to everywhere, and sort of almost fluid movement through airports, etc. And that's very much come to a rapid halt again with we are now quite the elaborate prep and check-in process and taking various PCR and lateral flow tests and all the rest of it. It's not convenient anymore, is it?
No, I think we've been taught a lot regarding communication without actually traveling or changing places, you know?
Indeed.
So it's been quite interesting.
Yeah.
The only thing which is not possible in one place only is racing. So
well, on Twitch, maybe.
Yeah, maybe. But that's not enough.
Do you have a Twitch account? Are you a streamer?
No, I don't. I don't. Actually, I have a simulator, of course, and I'm using it regularly. We have to. But I'm not the kind of... I've never tried streaming, and I think... I mean, there are many others doing a great job streaming, so I'll
so you leave it. You leave it to them.
Yeah, I leave it to them.
Well, I wonder sometimes as well. I mean, as you may have heard and I've mentioned before, I have so much respect for the level of concentration and focus that you racing drivers, you know, keep consistently as well. And we'll touch on that in a minute, of course. And you're also an endurance racer. You race 24 hours and so on. It's amazing to see your focus, consistency, and which I totally wouldn't have. But then to be talking and commentating at the same time and keeping a mass audience entertained and sort of answering questions in the chat. I can't even imagine doing that. And it must be tough.
I think it's a huge challenge, honestly. And I think you need to practice it also, because I can only imagine it from, you know, we sometimes did some onboard laps, commented onboard laps, where you have the microphone attached to your suit and everything. And feels quite weird to talk in the racing car while driving. It's something which you're definitely not used to, commenting on what you are doing now.
Explaining your intuitive driving, yes.
Yes, and that's it. And that feels strange. So I have the biggest respect also for those people doing nice streaming.
Yeah, definitely the people listening to the onboard labs, they don't constantly want to hear, whoa, oh, should have paid attention to that one. Left, left, left.
or my tires are gone,
No, it has to come sort of naturally. And I realize I'm rubbish at multitasking anyway, I guess many men are. But what I noticed the other day is I basically had one scene in my studio live presentations here when we had the novelty presentation for the pilots, where I basically had to walk from camera position A to camera position B, take a watch off my wrist, put that watch on the tray, put presentation gloves on, face a new camera, and at the same time explain a testing setup in the physics department of the University of Cambridge. And literally, this took me like, normally I'm quite all right at sort of just winging it and just making stuff up, but I literally had to practice that like 7-8 times because you have so many things going on in your head. And that's kind of just before we get into sort of your whole like racing career, but maybe just how intense is the workload in the cockpit? I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on at the same time.
Yeah. I mean, I think sometimes you don't even realize how much stuff is going on because a lot of things are working automatically. Otherwise, you couldn't do it anyway. But I think you've got to, look at temperatures, give information to engineers at the right time, look at traffic, focus on, of course, the car, focus on sounds, especially in endurance racing, if there are special sounds coming up in the car. Mm.
Special sounds.
Sort of
burnt rubber.
Everything you don't want to hear. Some strange noises clonking or anything. Yes, for example. and if you just there's a lot of things going on, and then trying to be on the limit as well for yourself and for the car while doing all these other things can be really challenging.
And when you get to, how long does it take to get to know a particular car until you're in a position where you can actually just sort of feel almost intuitively if the car's all right or if something needs attention?
I think it's a little different for every racing driver because you get to know a car by heading towards its limits or over the limits already to have feeling about how it reacts if it's over the limit, And there are some drivers which are very fast at this point and others which are not so fast. I've always been a driver not pushing a car over its limits immediately, just simply because of the fact that I've been racing quite but I've been racing quite a long time with very, very small budget. And if I would have destroyed something or crashed or anything, I couldn't have driven anymore.
Yeah, that would have been the end of business class, definitely.
Yes, definitely. No business class in these times. So I've always been a driver trying to, come from top, from down to top and doing it step by step. I think if you have maybe 1 or 2 days and then you should know a car pretty much.
That's something also that, and well, again, this is also part of the reason why we're talking today. But this was David Coulthard's feedback as well from the 300 SL Goldwing that obviously in this classic racing environment, you have to go and race in a car with basically almost zero prior, testing feel for the car. It's not that you've sort of tested the tires for laps on end and know how the car is going to behave. Plus, you've got something which is also quite valuable and expensive underneath your backside, and which you don't want to write off necessarily. And then you find that everybody else is quite aggressive in the race, and you're like, "Whoa, okay." And that's that must be, and that's always we see the difference with Formula One. It's these ladies and gentlemen, they have a lot of testing behind them, obviously, to get to know the car and to know exactly what's going on.
Sure. And also, I mean, with the Gullwing, this is such a special car. It's also a complete different car than, for example, I'm racing now all the time. So that's not if you if you try two different GT3 cars, no. They are so much closer to each no. other than if you try something completely different, like the 300 SL Gavin.
Absolutely. This is, yeah, it's a lot more of a rustic experience for sure. You're racing
such
KTM.
It's a beautiful car.
It is indeed, yes. But you're racing KTM at the moment, yeah? Which is the...
Yes.
It's the crossbow, right?
Or yes.
Expo, or whatever you call that.
It's crossbow is fine. Yes. So yeah, I'm racing for KTM, the KTM crossbow, the GT4 and the GTX, both wow. models. Yeah.
Yeah. And there's one, I mean, there's, you know, when the sort of the car design people like me think of KTM, we think of things without a roof where in sort of go-karts, but there is actually a KTM now with a proper roof.
Yeah, absolutely. Since 2016 already, the GT4, the KTM Crossbow GT4, which is a GT4 homologated race car. Mm. And we've been racing it internationally since 2016. It has a roof and it's like a GT4 car. And the GTX now also has a roof, of course, because, I mean, that's a car with... 530 horsepower and 1,050 kilos. So it needs a roof, definitely.
It needs a roof. And it's quite a raw experience also sort of in the roofless models. I mean, I remember one of the racing drivers taking me around the track in one of those aerial atoms, you know, where you're literally strapped to the engine. It feels like it's almost like a motorbike just with four wheels type situation. And you're sitting in there and it's a completely different experience when there's no windscreen, no roof, and you're sort of just, you're feeling everything. It's quite brutal.
It's very pure, you know.
That's one way to, it's a lot of flies.
also. But I learned driving race cars actually in these cars and in the KTM Crossbow in the open top car. And there is no ABS, there's no traction control, nothing in this car. So I always had the feeling that it was great to learn driving race cars in these cars because it's very pure and very, as you say, kind of rough, but it's pure driving experience in the end of the day.
Yeah.
There's nothing really that helps you. It's you with the car and it's your skills.
Yeah.
Left foot is your ABS.
Absolutely. And I watched the driver who took me around in the aerial where basically I don't think there were many sections on the track where he actually had what I would call grip. I think most of it was kind of in floaty mode. And you could see, obviously, the feet being quite busy kind of doing this manually. And I think I would have been off the track sort of in turn one, probably. And it's amazing to see how, you know, for me, this constantly feels wrong. You know, it constantly feels like you're actually just about to have a massive crash. But you actually start to get comfortable in that mode, right?
Yeah, absolutely. The funny thing is, the very first time I tried a race car with ABS was then the GT4 from KTM. Which has ABS system inside. And I didn't really properly use it in the beginning because this felt wrong for me.
Yeah.
That it felt wrong for me not to regulate the braking pressure myself. So
it still feels wrong for me in a road car, I have to say.
Nowadays I love the ABS. I appreciate it, especially in the rain. Hey,
yeah, that's true.
Absolutely.
not like the recent Italian Grand Prix where all of our friends in Formula One sort of also didn't find any grip whatsoever.
that was very entertaining in a strange kind of way.
It was indeed.
Yeah.
For me, this is always a huge opportunity. Because it's those races when I know that maybe I can get one of those front wing end plates with the IWC logo to display in my office or shop. Because when they lose them a lot, then it's always an opportunity for me to collect some.
There should have been a few from this race, I guess.
That's for sure.
But so, I've never thought about that. Yeah, that's an interesting thought.
No, but literally the one that's in the in our boutique in Zurich, which you have to come and see at some point, IWC Racing Works, that was literally Valtteri's front wing end plate from the Abu Dhabi GP in 2019. I was sitting, I was standing next to Toto and you could see Valtteri having this little skirmish, and this end plate was just basically flying across the TV screen on the official feed in absolute slow motion, sort of, you know, spinning.
Oh my God.
The IWC logo was sort of spinning across the screen. And then the marshals are all over it and basically, you know, asked Toto, can we send somebody out to actually collect this? And then they did. They radioed out to the marshals and they collected it for us, and now it's in the boutique. So it's a nice little memento. from that race, definitely.
Yeah,
definitely.
That's really cool, hey.
So let's have a conversation a little bit about your racing history and career. So you literally started on karts, right?
Yeah, right. And I started with karting at 12. At the age of
and was
12.
That sort of the, yeah. What was your first moment when you realized that you had an interest in racing and loving things in four wheels? How did that happen?
I think like it's always been a kind of family tradition to look Formula One on Sundays.
Yeah.
My dad has always been into cars. My brother has always been into cars. I've just been after my brother all the time. Mm. And so car racing has always been a part, but actually I never really considered being a racing driver for myself. When I was 12 years old, I got the possibility to try a race car. And actually there was someone besides the track who told my dad, oh, that doesn't look too bad what she's doing in there.
Oh, good.
And yeah, so they asked me if I had fun, and I had more fun than I've ever had. So I definitely wanted
start.
To, yeah, I definitely wanted to try this. And yeah, then I, a week later, I had my card and my helmet and everything. And 2 weeks later, I drove my very first race. And
wow.
Yeah, basically like this, it started and never really ended.
That's it. That's quite the introduction to racing. Two weeks after you had your first go, you were racing.
Yeah, I mean, we spent whole holidays, my brother and me, on racetracks near our hotels where our parents dropped us, you know, in the morning and got us again in the evening, because we were trying to drive carts all day, you know, on rental car tracks. And we helped the mechanics there, and we talked to the people, and we drove the cars whenever we could. So.
Well, you brought your own mechanics?
No, we helped those mechanics,
right, okay.
You know.
I was going to say the Kaihammer team comes to the Mallorca holiday karting track with their own engineering setups. So, right, guys, okay.
Oh, no, far away from that. At this point, it was all just fun, you know. I never really considered it. It was never, as there is no racing background in my family, being a racing driver never really was, you know, a thing. It's really born with passion, more or less, a passion that you have the privilege to find and experience, and then, yeah, can turn into a job.
I know this is sort of my standard question in this context, but I've got to ask, what was the first car moment you remember? I mean, I don't know if your house was sort of the toy car house and you had maybe one of those that you remember, or was there a car that you saw early on when you were a child that you sort of connected with, or you thought, oh, that sort of left an impression, or not at all? No car posters on the wall in early
there are a lot of drawings from me. I, as a child, where I painted the car.
Really?
From my dad, like a Porsche.
Oh, cool.
And my very first own car, I got it with 18, was an old Mini Cooper.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Very old, 1990s, as a not so old, obviously, but
old enough.
It's old enough. And it's a very small car without power steering, you know, and everything. And I absolutely love it. I don't remember like a car moment itself. I just know there are millions of drawings of cars from me as a child. And
you were good at drawing in those days? I mean, you had talent?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
No, absolutely. A complete artist, no jokes. I mean, you can see it's a car, but it's not. You cannot say, "Oh, it's a Porsche."
Ah, right. Okay. No, because you know, cars were always. You know, I was totally into drawing in my sort of early and late teenage years, especially, and I always struggled with cars, and that's why in the end I switched over to doing mainly sort of sci-fi flying cars, because I didn't have the problem with the wheels in perspective. So it's a lot easier actually to get the body right, kind of without wheels,
yeah.
But it's the wheel bit. I mean, even now, like when I doodle during maybe not so exciting Zoom meetings, I draw cars from the front and the back mainly because I don't have that perspective issue in the wheels.
Perspective issue, yeah.
Still
no.
Can't do it.
I'm happy to show you some drawings from myself.
Yeah,
as
let's
a
do
child.
That.
Let's absolutely. Do
we should have an Insta gallery of Laura's and Chris's early car attempts.
Yeah,
I'll find some.
That would be great. We could make a whole exhibition out of that, probably. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But then let's look a little bit at your different career stages. I mean, you've done 24 hours Nürburgring, things like that. I think I've seen you in Audi R8 GTs and stuff like that as well. And then the KTM. So talk us a little bit through your racing journey.
Yes. So basically, when I started with 12, the karting career, I had to end it with 16 just because, you know, we all know that racing is a financially intense sport, and I just simply didn't have the financial support to race cars at this time. And I mean, my parents knew that this was my biggest passion, and I always hoped I would get the chance to start racing again, but I only got it with 22 years. So I had a pause of 6 years in between, and with 22 I started racing in the KTM Crossbow series, which was a series with 35 to 40 starters, all the same cars at this point. And it was tough, but it was so good to learn. Competition was high, and in the first year I had a lot to learn, really. And in the second year I won the series.
Wow.
And yeah, and that was I was incredibly lucky because KTM then started talking and to support me with the racing, and I was allowed to move into the GT4, and I started driving GT4 internationally, European series. You know, this was all brand new for me. While having the break, I studied law and economics. I worked at Audi. I basically had a normal life, but always with this passion, which I tried to find a way to get into again. And after then getting the support from KTM and being on in an international series, which went very well in the first year, I changed into the KTM marketing because racing started to get more and more intense. The weekends, you know, added up. And I said, at this point, I never believed that this would be my job at some point, you know. As we all know that racing is financially so intense, I would have never thought to get so far, actually. Yeah. It's always something you work towards too, but there are so many big talents out there which don't have the background and can't do this, that you just cannot rely on it.
So how does it work when you enter a series like the KTM in the first year? Do you rent the car? Do you have to buy the car outright? Is there a package you can buy from the series or KTM, or how does it work?
Yeah, both. You can either buy a car, you can either rent a car. But I rented a car at this point and just bought a package for a mechanic, which would help me to set up the car and then just drive.
And that means you don't have to take the car home, I presume. It kind of stays with the...
Yes, sure. It stays with the team. It's very basic, but it's really nice. You come to the racetrack, you have your car, which is perfectly in shape. You get into the car, have lots of driving time, and after the weekend, you can get home again.
And I guess it comes with insurance. So if you do write it off, you can sort of just drop it off and say, okay, see you next time, guys.
I don't even remember how it was at this time, but racing insurance is a big thing.
Yeah, definitely.
No worry. Yeah, that's a sensitive topic.
A sensitive topic. Yeah, I can imagine.
It
is like it is with mum and dad in your first car, I suppose. I remember very well the look on my dad's face when I brought back my very first car in not so great a condition after my first trip to London.
Oh, my God.
They weren't very impressed.
I can imagine. My mom was on the racetrack only twice with me. And the second time I took her was in the GT4 series. And she took me aside and said, "Laura, you never told me those cars are so fast." And I was like, "Yeah, mom, but what do you expect me to do?"
It's a race car.
Yeah, of course. that was when I was in, under, like I was, I had the job already with KTM. So yeah, she just didn't really realize, I think.
Has she ever gotten in a car with you since, or was that it?
No, that was it. She has never seen the new car driving in reality.
So now,
which is even quicker.
Yeah.
So
if you go somewhere now, you take two cars, eh? You and your mom.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I tell you that the biggest racing drivers often are the family members themselves.
Yeah, yeah.
Honestly.
Definitely.
Like I would say my mom and my grandma and my dad are driving far quicker on the road than I do.
Yeah, see, well, they haven't got the kind of the outlet and the release that you have on the racetrack. So they've got to get it from somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I understand this as well.
I also love this sort of communication that is going on between. I mean, obviously we could talk for hours about drivers and passengers, but which is sort of a huge theme, you know. And I'm sure everybody in a relationship has their own experience with the different perspectives in which seat you're in. I love that, you know. My mum, I mean, bless her, but when she gets into any car with me, before we even start, she would basically start like squeezing her feet into the footwell, finding secure grips with both hands, sort of, you know, bracing herself against the dashboard and holding on for dear life. No, just look at her. I said, "Mom, we haven't put the engine on yet."
Oh, that's awesome.
We're only going to that's the station. Awesome. Okay, it's going to be all right.
Yeah.
And she's the one who always gets tickets, by the way. She's the one who always gets. And she said, "Oh, yeah, I got flashed again." I said, "See, Mom, but every time you get in the car with me, you're like holding on for dear life." It's anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. I always listen to comments like, "I don't know who you got this racing from.
Definitely not from
passion
me.
From. Definitely not from me." And I'm like, if I drive with her on the road and she's going far too fast, I'm like, "Mom, did you like?
Did you see that pedestrian?
What? Okay, it's not that bad. No, they are good drivers, but yeah, the worst is my grandma. She's just the quickest driver of all."
Yeah, I don't know if you have that in Austria, but I always remember from the UK, they were like car insurances that basically offered you a discount if you installed a black box in all of the cars in your family that would monitor your driving behavior, and it would give you points.
Really?
Yeah, and you could actually run a comparative sort of league table within your family of who's the most responsible and energy efficient driver, who doesn't, you know, no rapid braking, none of that. So can you imagine?
Oh my God, that's great. I mean, if it wasn't so obvious in my family, I would say I would need something like this. Yeah, probably.
Oh dear. But, yeah. No, but anyway, we're hinting at that already, you know, from the world of modern sophisticated cars with proper sort of monocoques and carbon fiber to the 1955 beauty but brutally raw and analog and mechanical 300 SL. And Laura, we're obviously very excited that should things go to plan and everything works out with the pandemic and all the rest of it, I'm wildly excited about you hopefully having a go for the IWC Classic Racing Team and our 300 SL going in Goodwood this year in October, if that goes ahead.
Yes, and luckily it's a date which there is no other race in or anything. So if everything goes to plan, that would be a dream come true.
It'd be fantastic.
Honestly.
Have you driven a 300 SL before?
Never.
Have you driven anything from 1955?
Not even close to it. Not even close.
Okay.
So I've seen a car only like a week ago in Munich in the Motor World, and I just went around the corner, you know, and it just suddenly the car was there, and my heart dropped. It's such a beautiful car. It's crazy. It's a great piece of engineering, and
Well, I think you won't be. Yeah, okay. No, it's a great piece of engineering, unless it's IC.
For these times. I mean, for times.
I know, definitely. It's awesome.
It's great. Yeah, it's awesome. This is pure racing.
I know. I was blown away, actually. I mean, the only time I've driven the 300 SL in anger, as it were, was during Mille Miglia in 2018, 17, 18?
Ah, 18, beautiful.
And it is, you know, once you get used to it, obviously for me in the beginning, the big shock, as you say, you know, no power steering and all the rest of it, you literally need all your strength and your entire body weight on the clutch, on the brakes. And obviously it has a hell of a lot of brake steer, but you just don't know whether it's going to be left or right. So it's a little bit of a of a gamble.
Obviously.
When you hit the brakes, and you really don't want to hit the brakes too late because this thing will otherwise just take you into the next wall or in the person in front of you. So there's quite a lot of quite a bit of margin you need in that car. But what is fascinating is for a car 1955, if you take this thing on the motorway, it'll literally go 200 plus kilometers per hour, no problem. It doesn't even feel like it's about to fall apart. It's quite solid. And that is, for those days, you know, quite an achievement. And I always remember this these stories about Mr. Uhlenhaut, the engineer, who I think he went almost deaf in the end from the noise in his various cars. But he actually always took great pride in the fact that he could go the insane distance from his hometown to the factory in Stuttgart in like an hour 10, like on cobbled roads back in the 50s. And you think like, okay, I mean, suicidal to say the least.
Yeah, absolutely. It's really a privilege. And also, you know, great drivers have driven this car with Karl Wendlinger and Bernd Schneider and David Coulthard, of course. It's just a huge privilege to ever drive such a car. And then, of course, Goodwood, I mean, is a unique event. And it's just perfect.
Yeah, I love that track. Have you been on the Goodwood track before?
No, never. I've never even made it to Goodwood. We wanted to go the last year, but it obviously didn't happen.
Yeah.
So I've never been there, but a car for me has been driven there already.
Okay.
Like my KTM Crossbow GT4 from 2017, I think, or 18, has been on display and been driven there.
Wow. It's a good track. I mean, it's quite fast, especially down the back straight and into the right hander and the chicane there. It's quite, you know, for you know, poor little inexperienced road drivers like me. It's quite scary at times. But it's definitely fun. And what is brilliant about Goodwood is obviously you have a whole range of all of these Listers and Jaguar E types and all of that stuff competing in that class. And it's quite full on and close quarters racing. Like, this is something that really blew me away when I first went to Goodwood members meetings. I thought people are going to be very sort of, you know, careful with their multi-million pound racing machines, but you know, they're in it to win it. You know, this.
I agree. I watched some videos, of course, and I was fascinated. But funny, I think that's always the case with races like these. I've seen many races with cars like this, which have been very valuable cars and everything, and the drivers are just, you know, all in.
Yeah,
we're racing.
Yeah,
we want to win,
which is great. I always think, because these machines were designed for that. You know, they were not designed to be on display 100% in a vacuum garage.
100%, absolutely. Absolutely.
That's why we say that we want our watches being worn and not being put into a safe, just in a pretty little collection. And that's always nice when we see things actually being used for the purpose they were designed for. Diving watches under the water, pilot's watches in the cockpit. So that's by the way, what Ingrid is, just a total sideway comment. But we saw yesterday, I was amazed that one of our Top Gun watches actually found its way onto the wrist of a French Navy pilot who was racing a Rafale against a Bugatti Chiron. Which was which was a race they just set up between Bugatti and the French Navy. I think it's just gone online in the Bugatti social media. You can watch it actually, and it's really, really cool. And the pilot in the Rafale is a client of ours in the French Navy, and we worked on with him on the Aeronaval Mark 18, which has the naval crest on the dial. He also wears the Maverick helmet, by the way, which is quite entertaining. And it's amazing to see. And that's obviously, that's something we always wanted to do as well. But it's so difficult to organize military fighter jets going against cars. We've done it with a Spitfire, but it's so tricky to organize, especially with the US Navy. It's not so easy to get a plane for.
I can imagine. Yeah. I've never had to organize something similar like this, but I can imagine it's not the easiest.
No, definitely not. And European air forces and air wings are a little bit more relaxed generally, but it is true. And in the beginning, when we started all the Top Gun stuff, you know, my bosses said to me, "But surely, let's just, you know, hire a couple of planes from the Navy." I said, "Let me explain this to you. This is taxpayers' money. You know, this is government equipment. You know, it's not like a commercial partner.
Absolutely.
It's quite a different world." But anyway,
you could only, yeah. I think you could only maybe arrange it with someone who owns, or a company who owns an old fighter jet or something.
Yeah, that's true. But obviously the vintage jets that people own privately are nothing like in terms of performance compared to a modern fast
true.
Jet.
And you of know, course.
The Tomcats, which were sort of the first real full power twin engine jets, they were basically all shredded or converted to, you know, gatepost display aircraft when they were decommissioned.
Sure. Because
none of them are privately owned anywhere. And of course, anything modern FA-18s and the like, Eurofighter, Typhoons, Rafales, they don't really sell them off.
Yeah, no, I can imagine. Yeah, but it's a cool idea anyway.
It's definitely fun. And we always, you know, that's the other thing we always notice. We did that when we tried to fly the Spitfire above the Goodwood racetrack, is the aviation authorizations that you need to fly things very low in close proximity to people. It's insane. It's much easier with a race car, actually.
Yeah, I can imagine.
So yeah, no, I mean, you know, the if the classic race goes ahead in autumn, that would be absolutely amazing. I would be so excited for you to have that experience and to make that dream come true.
Yes.
And you know, David won the trophy last time, so no pressure, Laura. But
I heard that several times already. Yes, I probably he could come to be good instructor. So
yeah, he is actually he is a good, like Maro is a good coach, and I'd love for you to have a go with me as well at some point to see.
Absolutely.
You'd probably be like your mum was. He's like, Chris, listen.
Don't go so
pull
fast.
Over. You put the hazards on, okay? Let's talk about this.
Enough.
Yeah. You know where it says breaking point? That's the moment you're supposed to break.
Yeah.
Properly. Not tentatively, properly. Definitely. So from cars to watches, Laura, this is the technical bit now. So can you explain to us the inner workings? No, I'm not going to go. No. But first watch, Laura, what's your first watch, if any, you ever wore, and why?
Oh my God. Yeah. So the very first and only watch I ever bought and owned my own was a Flick Flack.
Cool.
Watch.
That was when you were 22 as well?
No. Actually, I think I was 5 or 6 years old. Yeah. There were these flick-flack watches in all kind of different layouts and designs with the, I don't know, in all kinds of colors and with huge numbers on it. And I was just trying to find out how to read watches.
I love the fact that you talk about watches like I talk about cars. The green one, you know, the one with the, you know, the bit on the back.
Oh my God, yeah, I'm sorry.
So Flick Flack's good. My daughter's got a Flick Flack, my middle-sized daughter. Now
really?
She's now upgraded to Garmin, and she passed the little one on to my 3-year-old. She's got the Flick Flack now. I think it's Hello Kitty.
Oh, yeah. I mean, sorry. Yes, I've got a Garmin as well, of course, for sporting reasons.
This interview is over.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks, bye.
Have you got the solar charging Garmin? Or?
No, I have a Vivo Active 3, which is just a, you know, a watch covering all the data for the sports that we have to do for the fitness.
Yeah.
And yeah, I basically wear it if I do fitness. Other than this, I wear my Flick Flack.
Yeah.
Obviously not, but probably I should search it.
I definitely.
Yeah, I have it. I have it. Absolutely. I could add it to the gallery.
Yeah. No, absolutely.
Gallery. But
you
We're
think,
planning.
You know, there's, you may not know this, but there's a lot of sort of friendly fighting between Garmin and IWC, because Garmin, a large part of Garmin is based here in Schaffhausen, and the rest of the smart device division of Garmin is over in Munich. So we are sort of, you know, some of my very close friends here in Schaffhausen work for Garmin, and we're obviously constantly in the process of either flogging mechanical watches to people or Garmins to people, and it's become a bit of a competition. So I'm at a slight disadvantage because of price point, as you can imagine.
Slight. I can only, I understand.
So from Flick Flack and Garmin to IWC, how was that for you?
Oh my God, feels so great. I can't even tell you. No, honestly.
Proper watch.
Proper watch. I can't wait to to have a watch in my hands, actually.
Yes.
And, yeah.
And we'll make sure that that happens long before Goodwood, so you can get used to it. Yeah. Do you have your eye on anything in particular?
No, honestly not. I mean, of course, I've been watching at all the watches, and my dad has an IWC already since years and years and years. Also here at KTM, the bosses have IWC watches, so they were delighted to hear about it.
Okay.
Actually,
I didn't know that. KTM is IWC inclined. I have not seen that so far.
I think that's just a personal thing from them. Absolutely.
Yeah, no, but, so you know, just some companies I come across it. You know, I see it obviously on social sometimes that certain CEOs are wearing IWC, but KTM, I haven't seen that yet. I'll look out for it.
Yeah. Yeah, look out for it. Yeah, since I know about this partnership, everybody's showing me their IWCs. So around me, there are so many people.
And you're the ambassador, so that's quite interesting.
And I'm the ambassador, yeah, obviously. And I can't wait, really. They are beautiful.
Look, we're hugely excited. I think it's fantastic. I'm really, really looking forward to hopefully seeing you in Goodwood then and enjoying a weekend of cars and racing and everything else together. And in the meantime, how's your calendar looking? Where are you off to next?
Yes, so that's a big surprise. I only got the news that, no, I can tell it. I'll tell it here. I'm off to the 24-hour race of Nürburgring.
Whoa, so head-to-head with Mauro.
Yes, head-to-head with Mauro, but a different class, of course.
Yeah.
And I'm driving the KTM Crossbow GT4 for KTM. Yes, and I really can't wait. It's it's just the biggest race in the year for me.
Yeah.
And it's the most challenging race, and it's the most exciting race. And these are always races you don't forget as a racing driver. I think you never forget. So,
no, definitely not. Let's hope it doesn't rain like it does at the moment when it comes to...
Yeah. I would hope for good weather.
How are you in the rain? Is that something that do you hate it? Do you like it? Is it sort of nonplus?
I like it, actually. But I would say, rain on the Nordschleife is just different than rain on any other track. Yeah. And the Nordschleife is very, very challenging itself. So you don't really need to add rain to rise the excitement more. I would prefer dry, but if the rain comes, it comes and we can handle it. So no problem.
That sounds fantastic. And see, I've never done the Nordschleife. I've never driven the Nordschleife. Obviously, I've watched all of the onboard laps. I've never done it. And obviously, now I'm not going to ask you to sit next to me because you clearly say you're not going to do that. So. But maybe you can take me on a taxi ride one day because I've actually
never been.
You
should come, honestly.
Yes. When is that? In 2 weeks' time or is that next week?
Yeah, 2 weeks.
2 weeks' time.
No, it's from 4th to 6th of June. It's that weekend, around that weekend, yeah.
Awesome. Thanks. Well, let's see if we can make that happen. That would be super exciting.
Would be great.
Fourth, I'm in Munich. I know that. Fourth, I'm in Munich. I'm in Motor World again. I'm actually going to meet someone. Yeah, I'm going to meet someone from the diecast community who's going to do a full roundup on the 300 SL. I'm going to do a nice little photo opportunity and tour of Munich. Yeah, no, definitely. Well, that's a fantastic project there, Motor World. I was blown away. I mean, 75,000 square meters, and there's some nice cars.
Yes, definitely. Absolutely. We will have one of the new KTM Crossbow GTX cars in there soon. That's
brilliant.
Why I've been there.
Mm. Ah, cool. Yeah, and we're also going to have the largest working IWC wall clock ever to be produced. A big pilot with 2.20 meters dial diameter, huge crown on the side.
No way.
And actually powered by, I think, 3 separate church clock movements to get the hands and that kind of,
oh my God.
Bigger components that we can make here in our machines in Schaffhausen. But that's going to be super exciting as well. And what a project. Fantastic space. Huh?
Yeah, crazy. It's a must for everybody who's interested in cars and engineering.
Go check it
and
out.
Watches, obviously.
Listen, Laura, best of luck for the Nürburgring. You know, we keep all our fingers crossed and show Mauro how it's done. And then
I will.
Let's hope that we can see each other in Goodwood or maybe even earlier. And let's hope that works
out.
And I can't wait to see you, Andy. IWC Classic Racing Team in the 300 SL and smash it for us there at the Tony Gaze Trophy. Thanks a lot, Laura. Good to talk to you. Speak to you soon.
Thank you. It was a pleasure. Talk to you soon. Take care.
Thank you for listening to today's episode. This is the Partners in Time podcast. Make sure you subscribe to never miss an episode. If you want to find out more, visit IWC.com. And you can, of course, follow us on Instagram. It's at IWC Watches. My Instagram is at Chris Granger Hare. Make sure you tune in. Speak to you soon.